ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff with you today. Well, Australia's wine industry's contraction continues. I'll bring you the 2025-26 export results soon.
And this is the first time that export volume has fallen below 600 million litres since 2004. And this is really mirroring a broader global trend of declining wine consumption over the past decade.
It reflects what we saw recently in the vintage report, the amount of wine grapes that are being produced in this country, but I'll get some more details on that soon. But first up today, it's now very likely the H5 strain of bird flu is spreading locally within bird populations in Australia. If it is confirmed, this will be the first time it's happened in Australia. Another 11 suspected H5 bird flu cases were reported today. That's 7 in the southeast and 4 on Kangaroo Island, and that's in addition to the 14 confirmed cases that we have seen in this state. Primary Industries Minister Claire Scriven explains the latest findings.
We've seen a number of crested terns in the Limestone Coast in particular. And we've had additional detections, which we have announced today, which have not yet been confirmed, but have been sent to the National Laboratory in Geelong for that confirmation. So it is highly likely that they are being that it is being spread locally, the H5 bird flu, but we do need to wait for that final confirmation from that national lab. We've had 4 detections on Kangaroo Island, one at Seal Bay, and in southeast we've had an additional 7 detections today, again all being confirmed, but they're highly likely. One at South End, one at Cape Jaffa, 2 at Port Macdonald, and 3 at Beachport. So we knew that this would happen. We've all been expecting bird flu to arrive on Australian shores at some time, because every other continent has had it now for a period of time. So it's not surprising that we are having these detections, and it is very likely that, particularly in those greater crested terns, that is local transmission. But we expect that to be confirmed either later today or tomorrow from the National Laboratory.
When you do confirm that there is local transmission, does that trigger any response?
Look, it doesn't trigger a different response at this stage. It's just really a matter of that awareness. We've been doing a lot of preparation over the last few years in terms of anticipating that H5 bird flu would get to Australia eventually. So that includes things like trying to make the seal colonies more resilient, for example, and get rid of feral cats in some of those really key areas so that things like the seal colonies can be more resilient to other diseases, including H5 bird flu. And within industry, we've been working closely with industry again for quite some time. So everyone knew it would get here. It doesn't trigger a specifically different response once we know that it is locally transmitted here, at least not here in South Australia. So it is that matter of continuing to be aware and encouraging people to report anything they see that's out of the ordinary to that emergency animal disease hotline.
This spread in South Australia, is this the first time that it's been thought that there is local transmission of the virus in Australia?
So this will be, if this is confirmed, it will be the first local transmission that is confirmed within Australia. Now, we've been doing a lot of surveillance, I think probably more than most of the other states. And so we're very appreciative that we've been able to pick these up early. But that might also feed into the fact that we are identifying this transmission, and we would expect to see it probably elsewhere around the country in the coming weeks or months.
How concerning are the Kangaroo Island cases?
I guess every case is concerning. We knew that it would get here, but now that it is, of course, that just changes things a little bit. What we've done with Seal Bay, where there's the sanctuary there for seals and seal pups, of course, it's their endangered species. There has been a lot of work in terms of trying to build up their resilience, so things like treating the pups for hookworm, the feral cat control that I mentioned, and pup shelters. But just as an additional precautionary measure, we're doing a temporary pause on the sanctuary beach tours that go onto the beach. And so people will still be able to experience the seals and have a guided tour on the boardwalk, but we won't actually be having a go on the beach because we don't want to put any additional threats from any other diseases, for example, on those seals, given that H5 bird flu may well be getting to them as well.
You've been speaking with the South Australian poultry industry on a regular basis. What's the situation for them, given there are increasing detections and potentially local transmission of the virus?
Yes, I've been meeting with the poultry industry online most weeks since the first detection in South Australia. And so they were, of course, prepared for the fact that this would eventually get to Australia. So their biosecurity plans are all in place. They've perhaps been enhanced or updated in recent weeks. And it's really important to note that we don't have any detections in poultry, in commercial poultry, anywhere in the country. So not here in South Australia, nowhere else in the country. But they are, of course, alert and aware. They've continued their preparedness. Just yesterday I was at a preparedness day with industry that's looking at some of the technology that they could use if it does get into poultry. But their real focus is keeping it out of poultry. So we know that the impacts could be very serious if it gets into a poultry shed, but so far we don't have any of that, and they are very focused on trying to stop that happening.
Are many free-range producers perhaps limiting the free range of their chickens?
A number may well be doing so. The federal government put out some advice several weeks ago suggesting that people might want to house their birds. There are options for mandatory housing orders, but we're not at the stage where that needs to be implemented at present, because although obviously these numbers are increasing and we expect them to continue to increase, overall they are still very low. We don't have any in commercial poultry, so they are still low numbers, but obviously we expect they will increase. But in terms of the commercial industry, they've been well prepared, and we're continuing our regular meetings to talk about any emerging issues and concerns that they have.
I'm speaking to South Australia's Primary Industries Minister, Claire Scriven. In another announcement today, artificial intelligence is being deployed in the Adelaide Hills and Southern Barossa region. Can you explain what the latest in this bushfire detection technology is?
Yeah, so this is the first time, I believe, anywhere in Australia that this technology is being installed as a fire protection in a peri-urban area. So we've had it in the southeast of the state, in the Limestone Coast, to protect the significant forestry estate there and the local communities. But this is the first time it's actually been installed in a peri-urban area. So it's at Mount Crawford. And the real benefits of the AI-powered fire detection is that early detection, because, of course, the sooner a fire is detected, the sooner it can be responded to. And the track record that it's shown in the Limestone Coast has been very, very impressive. There's been many, many fires that have been prevented from spreading because of that early detection. So having this now in Mount Crawford is important and a great step forward. Been really, really pleased with the partnership with the CFS, with local government and with landscape boards and, of course, Forestry SA. And I think it's, this doesn't replace the human aspect of fire detection, it enhances it. So it's an additional tool, which is just so important. I mean, we've seen the horrific wildfires in Canada and in Europe at the moment. It really just does remind us of the importance to always be vigilant. And here we are able to see a further investment in terms of having an extra tool in the toolbox for early detection of bushfires.
Especially given this is shaping up to be a potentially very dangerous fire season this coming summer.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've been very fortunate this last few years, but at the same time, the number of fires that have been detected using this AI technology in the Limestone Coast may well have contributed to the low numbers of fires in the Limestone Coast. But it's really important that we have horses for courses. Obviously, a peri-urban environment is very different to the sort of relatively flat forested areas of the Limestone Coast. So this is a matter of seeing how well does it work. AI is continuing to learn all the time, of course. It refines its knowledge and understanding, if I can use that term, with all new pieces of information that it obtains. So it's something that is continuing to evolve in a positive way, and we look forward to seeing the outcomes of this particular installation.
Primary Industries Minister Claire Scriven speaking there. But as you heard, there is the news that South Australia's sea lion bay, the sea lions and seal colonies there, are now in close proximity to birds that have the H5 bird flu. And obviously, this H5N1 virus has been deadly for seals and sea lions overseas. Australian Marine Conservation Society Campaigns Director Alexia Welbelove joins me. Good afternoon.
Hi, Cathy.
How concerning is today's information that bird flu has possibly been found on KI?
I think it is really concerning, sadly. I think, you know, this is the news we'd already always feared, but, you know, predicted given the experience we've had with bird flu internationally that this was a likely event. But it does seem highly likely that this is local transmission, as the Minister has said.
Why does local transmission change the scheme for you?
Well, I think what we know about bird flu from international experience is that we don't know a lot about it, and it is slightly unpredictable. There is scientific evidence from research of transmission from birds to mammals and back again. And what we saw in South America is that 30,000 sea lion pups were killed in 2022-23. And then from June to August, the virus rocketed up from the southern tip of Chile up to Argentina. So what we know is that this, once it does transmit, it transmits incredibly quickly with devastating consequences for our marine wildlife. So if we take that international example, which is the only thing that we can go on, then having a positive detection in Seal Bay, which is one of the largest Australian sea lion colonies, it's incredibly important for the population. Obviously, Australian sea lions are only found in Australia, only in South Australia and Western Australia. And that Seal Bay population of Australian sea lions contains 5% of the global population of Australian sea lions, which are endangered. And there's only 12,000 of those individuals left. So if we take the South American example where 30,000 pups were killed from bird flu, if we take the Heard Island example from this past summer where 13,000 pups are reported to have been killed, if there is transmission and there is local transmission proven, it could be devastating for the Australian sea lions, which, you know, we're incredibly concerned about.
The government has done a lot of work in building resilience, but are there more direct assistance methods such as a vaccination or things like that yet?
Well, that's right. I mean, there has been a program of hookworm vaccinations, as the Minister just said, that have been really welcome. That's been really good to help build resilience to the population. But there's other things we can do to help look at how can we help their haul-out sites, some of which have been impacted by climate change, potentially further disease prevention. But, of course, the Australian sea lions are under a lot of pressure. The recent and ongoing algal bloom is likely to have impacted them. We don't really understand yet, you know. But for any animal to be able to be in the best possible state to fight viruses, they need to be healthy. And so obviously, we are encouraging the government to invest in resilience for threatened species populations like the Australian sea lion to make sure that they are at the best possible state they can be.
And you have also been looking for more government support as far as funding goes to establish a $200 million National Wildlife Resilience Fund. You've been calling for that for a couple of months now. Have you had any traction on that?
We haven't had any further commitments from the government at this stage. We do acknowledge that there has been significant work done by both federal and state and territory governments, you know, for preparedness. But what we're asking for is, and, you know, some of that has been focused on resilience and hookworm vaccinations in the case of Australian sea lion. But we do think there is more that can be done. And I think now that this, we've moved to a different stage, I believe, through local transmission, we are encouraging governments to put further funding into threatened species, and not just the Australian sea lion. There's a whole raft of threatened species that have been identified at risk from bird flu.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Alexia Welbelove, the Australian Marine Conservation Society Campaigns Director, speaking there about the news that there are 11 more suspected cases of the H5 bird flu, and it is now very likely the H5 strain is spreading locally in South Australia at least. It is 19 minutes past 12.
We can build a stronger future for our people.
The ABC is looking for trailblazers, 18 to 28, with a drive for making change in their regional communities.
Applications close August 1.
abc.net.au/trailblazers.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's great to have your company today. We'll shift to wine now, and Australian wine exports have dropped to the lowest level in more than 20 years as global consumption drops. We've been hearing this story for some time now that around the world people are just drinking a lot less wine, and Wine Australia's Manager for Market Insights, Peter Bailey, can explain the findings.
Australian wine exports declined by 7% in value to $2.3 billion and 6% in volume to 598 million litres in the year ended June 2026. And this is the first time that export volume has fallen below 600 million litres since 2004. And this is really mirroring a broader global trend of declining wine consumption over the past decade.
This also is in line with Wine Australia also reporting that the 2026 wine grape crush has shrunk to its lowest amount in more than 25 years as well. Is this showing the industry finding a new level if the vintage and the exports are both down to what it was about 20 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. So what the industry is doing is adjusting to these new demand conditions. So world wine consumption has fallen to its lowest level since 1961, and we're seeing consumers increasingly moderate their alcohol intake. There's also cost of living pressures and also a shift towards other alternative beverages. So fewer consumers are drinking wine, drinking occasions are less frequent, and those who do consume wine are increasingly moderating their intake or even abstaining completely.
And when you look at where the wine is going, it looks like it's down through the top markets for value and volume. Where is our wine going, though, that is going overseas?
Yeah, so the decline in Australian exports was really driven by weaker demand in our three largest export markets, being mainland China, the United Kingdom and the United States. So mainland China was our largest export market by value, despite exports falling by 15%. As that initial post-tariff recovery and restocking phase came to an end. However, while exports to mainland China did decline, Australia still remains the leading source of imported wine in that market.
Obviously, China is the big player in Asia, but outside of mainland China, there was a lot of focus in diversifying markets, particularly when China put those tariffs on Australian wine. Is there still interest from other Asian nations?
Yeah, absolutely. So Asian markets outside of mainland China delivered really strong growth. So export value increased significantly in Singapore, Thailand, Malaysia, Japan, South Korea and Taiwan. So Singapore became Australia's largest Asian market outside of China, while Thailand achieved record export values driven by growing demand for premium Australian wines.
I know premiumisation has been a bit of a key for winemakers looking to export. Is that premium end suffering as much as the broader market?
No, really the export declines were concentrated in the lower and mid-price segments, reflecting the weaker global demand and ongoing inventory adjustments in key markets. So the largest fall in exports occurred in the 250 to 499 per litre segment, which was down 20%. But conversely, we actually saw some increases in the $10 to $15 per litre and $15 to $20 per litre segments. And they indicate while overall export demand softened, those premium price Australian wines remain relatively resilient.
And in a rare bright point from this report, Canada, which was a standout performer in the last export report as well, is still quite strong.
Yeah, absolutely. So Canada was the standout performer throughout the period, with export value increasing 20% to $188 million. And that's at the highest level in 7 years. And we also saw volume rise by 13%. And you know, this growth did stand out against the backdrop of declining wine consumption generally in Canada, with Australia's growth supported by market share gains following reduced availability of US wines during the Canada-US trade dispute. However, we did see that growth momentum soften towards the end of the period, suggesting that that market share gain is beginning to stabilise.
There has been quite a lot of effort a lot of effort has gone into trying to improve Australia's market share in the US, but it really has been quite a slog there, and it seems like the US is particularly proving challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. So the US data really points to weaker demand across all price categories in that market, which suggests Australia's challenges in the US extend beyond entry-level wines and reflect wider market headwinds, including declining wine consumption, increased competition from domestic and imported producers, retail inventory reductions, and changing consumer preferences towards alternative alcoholic beverages. So, you know, overall, the United States remains one of the largest contributors to the global decline in Australian wine exports. And it's going across different wine styles as well. So it really reflects that structural challenge in the market rather than just a downturn confined to any single category.
Is much of the wine that's being exported wine that had previously been in storage?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you saw with our 2026 crush, we've actually produced less wine over the last few years. So even though the volume of exports has fallen, we've actually reduced how much we've produced, which would help reduce the overall inventory levels in Australia.
And the vintage report also showed that Chardonnay was now the main, the most produced grape in Australia after years of Shiraz and red wine grapes being the dominant players. But it does seem like Chardonnay took a particular hit in this report as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the decline occurred across basically all wine styles and all colours and all varieties. So it's not just related to red wine, even though red wine contributes about 80% of the overall decline. We are seeing those declines across most varieties. So again, that really is reflecting that, you know, the fall in global consumption globally.
Wine Australia's Manager for Market Insights, Peter Bailey, speaking there. We'll head to the Bureau of Meteorology now and get the latest in the forecast. Tom Anderson joins me. Good afternoon.
G'day, Cathy.
So this wintry weather continues. What are you seeing?
Yeah, just about that. We're seeing winds easing across the state, especially across coastal parts at the moment, but just bringing some more cold air over much of South Australia. We've got some cloud cover for most of the state, and then this is basically just going to sort of hang around for the next couple of days. We've got another high pressure system coming overhead, so A, it's going to make the winds relatively light, and B, that's just going to basically trap this colder air mass in. So yeah, we are just going to see the maximum temperatures across much of the sort of southern half of the state being between 12 to 15 degrees for the next couple of days, at least throughout the working week, and then maybe only a couple of degrees warmer through the pastoral district. So pretty cold, relatively settled, and not expecting too much rainfall over the coming days.
Right, and so winds are dropping. What's looking like when it comes to rainfall totals?
So over the next 4 days, so getting us through to the end of Sunday, we are looking at probably less than a millimetre for the northern agricultural area, possibly between 1 to 5 millimetre for the southern agricultural area, and we might see some isolated falls about the Mount Lofty ranges between 5 and 10 millimetres. But yeah, not expecting too much in terms of rainfall. And the only other thing probably to note over the coming days is we're going to see the return of a bit of frost and fog. So we'll start seeing fog patches tomorrow morning about, especially the Riverland, but then much of the eastern parts of the state might see some fog for Friday and into Saturday.
Looks like some pretty chilly minimums too.
Yes, yeah, so we're going to get frosty conditions to go along with that fog as well. So we will see probably back to the return of a few stations getting in the negatives overnight with those really calm and frosty conditions. And then, yeah, a lot of the state will see that minimum temperature overnight probably below 5 degrees.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Cathy.
Tom Anderson from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking there. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be mostly sunny. There could be some patches of morning frost in the far east there as well. Overnight temperatures falling to between 2 and 5 degrees, with the daytime temperatures reaching around 16. The lower western will be partly cloudy. There could be areas of morning frost in the far east and maybe the chance of some morning fog near the South Australian border as well. Overnight temperatures are falling to between 1 and 4 degrees, with the daytime temperatures reaching about 15 degrees. It's coming up to 29 minutes past 12.
I'm Maureen McGillicuddy.
And I'm Edith Vale.
And we host Another Cuppa,
where we natter away with some of Australia's biggest names.
Pop the kettle on with Granny Bingo.
Woke garbage.
Exactly.
Search Another Cuppa podcast on ABC Listen.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
This is the Country Hour across South Australia and Broken Hill. And coming up, the Eyre Peninsula's seafood producers have met with the Peak Body Seafood Industry Australia to hear about a new collaboration with the Blue Economy CRC. I'll tell you a little bit more about that. And those hard-working little dung beetles do so much for our soil across the world. But in South Australia, you'll hear how they could actually help reduce methane emissions, or at least mitigate some methane emissions from livestock. That's coming up in the next half hour. But first, we have to get the latest in news headlines with Matt Coleman. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this afternoon, 11 new suspected cases of the H5 bird flu have been detected in South Australia, with the state government saying it's highly likely the virus is spreading locally. 7 of the 11 suspected cases were detected in the southeast and 4 on Kangaroo Island. The Primary Industries Minister Claire Scriven says she's awaiting further test results from interstate. Police are treating the death of a woman and her toddler found in waters off the state's southeast as a murder-suicide. The bodies of the 36-year-old woman and 23-month-old girl were spotted on Monday after the woman's car was found abandoned with its engine running near Port Macdonald. The woman's 3-month-old son remains missing. And inflation eased slightly in June as oil prices came down globally. The headline figure was 3.8% for the year to June. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Matt. To the Eyre Peninsula now, and EP Seafood Producers have recently met with Peak Body Seafood Industry SA to hear about a new collaboration with Blue Economy CRC. Coming together in Port Lincoln, it was an opportunity to meet with the new CEO, Connie Benaros. Ms. Benaros says it was a good chance to hear from producers about the current issues they're facing and also explore the future of seafood in South Australia.
Yeah, look, we had a trip just recently in Port Lincoln. It was an opportunity to, I guess, meet with Blue Economy CRC. They are one of the Commonwealth Research Centres and also the National Peak Body Seafood Industry Australia as part of a catch-up that we have in Port Lincoln with our board and planning strategies. And I guess the purpose of that was really to bring us up to speed with a body of work that's been taking place now for the last, well, close to 24 months, and I guess is due for some updates very soon. A couple of years ago, there was a first of its kind partnership between Blue Economy CRC, Fisheries Research and Development, the Commonwealth Government, and the Seafood Industry Australia National Peak Body to deliver Futures of Seafood. And that was the single most comprehensive evidence-based project ever undertaken in Australia, into Australia's seafood system and the entire seafood system, the challenges, the opportunities that it has, and also, I guess, more importantly, in terms of identifying all those things, outlining a strategic reset for Australia's domestic seafood production, its sovereignty and a growth plan over the next 10 years. And that body of work has been undertaken now. So that visit to Port Lincoln was really about Blue Economy CRC and Seafood Industry Australia bringing us up to speed with the final roadmap, what that looks like, what the opportunities there are, not just for South Australia, but all jurisdictions. They've been doing this across the nation. And leading into what will take place next week, which is the National Seafood Conference.
And so the work that Seafood Industry Australia has been doing as part of this Futures of Seafood, this is now continuing on with some more work with Blue Economy CRC?
Yeah, so Blue Economy, as I said, that partnership is continuing. The final roadmap is due to be released very soon. I think there's lots of people hoping that next week at the conference there'll be an update in relation to where that's at. And I suppose giving everyone some confidence about the next 10 years and what a strategic reset could look like for the Australian seafood industry and how we take that and the learnings from that and implement any changes that we need at a state level. And there are lots of learnings from that, which, you know, a lot of them can be, I think a lot of them are what people in the industry for a long time have expected. But it's one thing, you know, having all those things confirmed, and another then working about how we go about resetting the strategic plan of the seafood industry nationally and at a state level, and what roles our Commonwealth counterparts have in that. What roles our, we have great partnerships here with SARDI, with primary industries. Partnerships are at the heart of everything that the seafood industry has to do and has been doing with the state government and with its departments. And we want to take those learnings from what we're doing, or what Blue Economy and Seafood Industry Australia have done to date, and mould that into what we're doing here in South Australia.
Cody, when you get into a room of those that are in the industry, it looks like there was a wide range of representatives from right across the Eyre Peninsula at the recent event. Do you get lots of questions? Do you get lots of suggestions? And what sort of things are discussed and put to you about what they'd like to see moving forward?
It's been a challenge. It's been the most challenging period that our seafood industry here in South Australia has ever faced, right? And that's off the back of, you know, what I think are diabolical challenges over the last few years, whether they be through, you know, trade disturbances with rock lobster, fuel shortages, prices in, or fuel hikes, climate volatility, and of course, algal bloom. But they're still standing. And I guess that's the critical part, that, you know, we always talk about seafood as such a resilient industry, and it is. And algal bloom has highlighted that, I think, in ways that nobody could have imagined. But I guess the next steps and you know, what we wanted to learn about and what we're working with all our partners on, and again, this is about partnerships with the state government, with our agencies here, and with what our Commonwealth counterparts have to contribute to that. We're still standing. Yes, we're resilient, but we want to move beyond resilience. We want to move beyond resilience to thriving, to shaping our own destiny here in South Australia. And so when you talk to people, you know, there's the micro level questions about, obviously, about algal bloom, first and foremost, and then talking to them about, I guess, that bigger vision of where we want to take seafood in South Australia.
And where would you like to see or take seafood in South Australia?
You know, I keep saying to people every time I get asked that question, I don't think, when I think about seafood, I always say seafood is an Australian way of life, right? We want to take, I think, that and run with it. And a really important element of that, from my perspective, is not just the partnerships, but taking the community on that journey with us. And look, algal bloom is a perfect example. When we ask, you know, South Australians to step up and support any industry that is doing it tough, they always do. And we should be very proud of ourselves, I think, for that. And we ask the same of South Australia throughout algal bloom. The government implemented an unprecedented algal bloom support package for our industry and the support that they needed to get through this algal bloom. And I guess we're getting to the next steps of that. And what's it going to look beyond, you know, post the summer plan coming to an end, or post the support packages coming to an end? And people want to know what that's going to look like for them, for their regions, for their towns, and what we're doing to take it to that next level that we need to get to ensure that we continue to have not a resilient seafood industry, but a thriving seafood industry. And can I say on that front, you know, I don't think anyone's more committed to shaping the future of our oceans and its sustainability from a seafood perspective and from an environmental perspective than our seafood industry. And our coastal regional towns are absolutely at the heart of that. So when you have those conversations on the ground with people in Port Lincoln, that's what you want to focus in on. What's important to you? What's going on the ground here that we need to know so that it feeds into that bigger picture strategy that all of us are working on in the background?
Seafood Industry South Australia CEO Connie Benares speaking with Brooke Nindorf. Now, we know bees are hard-working little ag workers, but dung beetles are pretty good too. And do you know if there are dung beetles on your farm? If not, it's something you may want to consider, because there's some new research that's found the small but mighty dung beetle can reduce cumulative methane emissions of decomposing manure by 85% and reduce the total greenhouse gas footprint by 18%. Study co-author and researcher at Southern Cross University, Professor Nigel Andrew, explains.
Well, we've found with the dung beetles, as we know, do great work in taking dung off the top of the surface of the in agricultural pastures. But and we've been looking at what extra benefits dung beetles give to agricultural environments. And so we essentially measured greenhouse gases, so CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, and also measured ammonia, to do a fairly straightforward experiment to identify if dung beetles that are found and actually working the dung change the greenhouse gas profile that's being released by the pats. And essentially what we found was that yes, the dung beetles can significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions that are released from dung pats, and particularly methane was really quite impressive. It was an 85% reduction in methane emissions from dung pats. And overall, if we put all the greenhouse gases together and do the calculations on them, so bring methane, nitrous oxide, and carbon dioxide together into one sort of calculation, the dung beetles effectively reduce the greenhouse gases by 18% across the life cycle of a dung pat.
You said they're impressive numbers, and they are. Did they surpass what you expected?
Well, we went into this not really knowing what to expect. We found that from the literature, I mean, methane primarily is released when cows burp, so when they're belching, But across, globally, the amount of methane that is released by dung can range from about 5% up to 30%. So the actual amount of methane that is in dung is quite variable. And most of the work that will all work up until now had been done in North America and Europe. So we were sort of flying, knowing that, obviously because dung beetles are beneficial to agricultural environments, in particular the introduced species, we thought, well, what added benefits can they bring by doing their job? So we expected them to have some benefit, but we know also that insects in general, particularly dung beetles, they will actually release carbon dioxide when they're respiring or when they're breathing, when they're active. But we didn't really expect them to be as good as they were. So yeah, that was a bonus.
You mentioned there that there are, different varieties, native and introduced. Are these results that are applicable to all dung beetles?
Well, this is the start. So this, we took a sort of, took four dung beetles and we essentially put them into these treatments in their abundances as we found them in the field at a particular time of the year. And this was done in northern New South Wales. And we did this in a controlled glasshouse environment. So one of the things that we can do from here is we're thinking, well, does this relate to other dung beetle species of the introduced species that are actually working in dung pats? Does it change between, from northern New South Wales up into South Australia, into Western Australia, into Southeast Australia as well? So one of the things that we want to test from here is how generally applicable it is. Does it change in different environments from sort of the moister regions to the drier regions? And also, does it change depending on the sort of the dung beetles that you naturally find in a cow pat? Sometimes, you'll find just a single species. Other times you might find five or six different species working together in different numbers. So there's lots of sort of differences that can come here, and they're all sort of waiting to be tested.
So how significant are these findings? Is this going to be, farming of the future? Will everyone be using dung beetles?
Well, everyone, yeah, dung beetles are the best thing. They're the farmer's friends. So if you've got a agricultural systems and you've got livestock, dung beetles are one of the key elements in your toolkit to actually keep the farmlands healthy. And we know that, to remove dung pats effectively, dung beetles are a key component of that. And this is essentially value adding. So when it comes to the point of, trying to work out carbon credits for farms, for example, knowing how much we've got good information about, sort of cattle belching, but this sort of adds to that to say, if you have dung beetles on your property, not only are you getting the benefits of removing the dung, but they're also, removing some of the greenhouse gases. So if we get to the point of being able to calculate greenhouse gas credit on farms, this will add to the value that farmers have when they've got dung beetles on their property and the dung beetles are working efficiently.
So there could be an increase in the popularity of using them?
Hope so. I mean, I think dung beetles are probably, you know, all farmers that I've spoken to are really excited when they have dung beetles on their property, and they're doing a good job. So if they should be one of the most beneficial sort of aspects of any insects on a lot of agricultural properties. So yes, the more dung beetles that farmers have, and particularly ones that are doing really good, being really efficient, it's a fantastic benefit for the agricultural sector.
Are there any limitations to speak of, Nigel? I've heard it can take a long time for them to kind of populate a farm in numbers that are useful. Is there anything else that might hold people back from putting them on?
The biggest problem for dung beetles being effective is drenching. So trying to reduce the parasites in agricultural sectors. Being insects, they are very susceptible to the chemical drenches and chemicals that are given to livestock, you know, to maintain their health. So usually, well, what I've found, and a lot of my colleagues have found, if farms are actually, they don't have dung beetles on their properties, it could be directly related to a lot of drenches that are occurring, and also not just drenching. It's usually drenching at the time when dung beetles are active as adults. So when they're actually flying around properties and also feeding on the dung, if most of the drench effectively goes out the back end of a cow, and so it ends up in the dung itself, and that effectively will kill off the dung beetles in that population. So that can be one of the biggest issues for farmers too, in terms of managing dung beetles, is also managing when they actually put their drenches on their livestock.
Researcher at Southern Cross University, Professor Nigel Andrew, speaking with Elsie Adamo. It's coming up to 14 minutes to one.
What's loaded with fun for the whole family? ABC iView.
Bring it!
From the investigators and caper crew to Andy Lee's Do Not Watch This Show.
You can keep watching.
Find it all on ABC iView.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, it's now that crucial time of year when thousands of beehives start making their way to the Riverland for pollination services. But with increasing almond plantings and varroa mite impacting bee colonies across the nation, those pollination services are becoming increasingly hard for local growers to source. Recent mapping of almond orchards across Australia has revealed more than 25% of all new trees planted in the past 3 years are self-fertile varieties, meaning they don't rely on bees for fertilisation. Self-fertile crops now make up 7.5% of all plantings. That's up 2% from 2023. Jim Sources started growing self-fertile almond trees in the Riverland about a decade ago.
I think overseas they were, you know, the varroa mite had started sort of being a problem, and we knew it was only time before it came to Australia. But the main reason is because we weren't a big almond grower to start with, so we were just worried that bees' supply was going to be a problem, so we had to look for alternatives.
How does it differ? Are the flowering and growth cycles different for self-fertile varieties compared to others?
Most almonds go through the same process of flowering and trying to get those flowers pollinated. But, you know, you don't get your whole orchard will flower together because it's one variety. You won't get, because traditional plantings have two or three different varieties in there that will have a slight different timing when they start flowering.
Does it change your farming processes at all?
Definitely a different way of managing an orchard. I think, for starters, a lot of the traditional plantings had dual irrigation systems because they had pretty much with different varieties. Like the late pollinators needed a different irrigation compared to your main varieties. So you sort of really only have to run one irrigation system for your whole orchard.
What about sprays and things like that?
Well, similar sort of processes with sprays. We're learning. We've only been doing it 10 years, so we're still pretty young at this game, so we're making mistakes, we're learning, we're moving forward.
Yeah, but I know with bees, you have to sort of be careful of the different sprays and so that sort of thing. That's not really a consideration as much for you guys?
It is. So, like, you're mainly using fungicides with almonds, but some of them you sort of would be spraying at night to sort of reduce any effects you have on bees.
How did you go with the information and support when you first decided these were the kinds of trees you wanted to put in? Was that tricky at all?
We sort of fell into it a little bit because we were over in America looking at Stonefield varieties at the time. So when we came across a variety we decided to go with, this looked pretty promising in America at the time. So we got pretty excited. We saw this no need for bees, one single harvest, one variety. And we took a chance with it, and it seems to be paying dividends at the moment, so that's good.
That is great. And do you feel like the knowledge in the industry has improved over the years, over those 10 years since you planted them?
Yeah, definitely. A lot more people, growers have planted self-fertile varieties, so we're learning off each other and passing. The industry shares a lot of information, which is great, because the industry moves forward together. It's not really, you know, secret squirrel business where everyone learns something and they keep it to themselves. You sort of share it for the benefit of the industry, which is great. So I've definitely learned off a lot of other growers more experienced than myself over the years and use that knowledge to improve.
And, you know, when you talk to your fellow growers, I assume there's others that have, the self-fertile varieties as well. What kind of feedback do you hear from them about how things are going?
I think when we first did it, no one had really done it with big numbers. There was only a handful of growers doing it, so we had limited figures to compare with. But now the growers are planting with a lot more confidence because I've seen results from those of us that started, you know, that decade ago.
Hmm.
But you really need to talk to your marketers if you're involved with Armaco or Riverland Almonds, because that's the source. That's where the product's going to go. So you need to start there and see what they want and work with them. You can't just wake up one morning and decide, I'm doing this.
Yes.
And then try and find a home for your almonds. You need to
work out the demand and
make the right calls, because that's where your product's going to end up in the end.
And, this harvest, a bit challenging. You've had some an unusual amount of rain, I will say, at this stage of the season. How did you go with all that?
Yeah, it was a bit of a tough one this year, It's like I said, we've only been doing it 10 years, but the guys that have been doing it for longer said they've never really experienced that either, so it was, you'd start, rain would come, you'd have to stop for a week, wait for things to dry out. But the almonds sort of held up reasonably well, which is very surprising, even though they didn't look very pretty on the trees for a while there.
Riverland's Jim Sortsis, almond grower there, speaking with Steph Nitschke. And we'll stay with horticulture, but of a different kind, some support in the sense that exoskeletons, they might sound like something from science fiction, but the technology is being used in construction and manufacturing and could soon be a part of agriculture as well. So exoskeletons are devices, they're almost like a backpack that's worn on the body to support movement. And the aim is to reduce the physical strain on workers, particularly those who perform intensive horticulture jobs. Hort Innovation has launched a new project to see how these exosuits can help ag workers. R&D Manager for Emerging Technologies, Eduardo Barbosa, explains the technology.
Yes, so this project was motivated by the idea of creating a safer and more productive horticulture industry by using exoskeletons to protect farm workers and prevent injuries and prevent other, types of conditions that can impact their jobs.
Can you explain to people what an exoskeleton is, please?
Sure. An exoskeleton is essentially a wearable device that helps support the body and makes physical work less tiring, less demanding.
And it sort of just looks like a backpack, really, this one you have here. What are we looking at here?
Yeah, so there are different versions of exoskeletons, and this one in particular is focused on protecting the back. But there are other versions, for example, to protect arms and shoulders. But we are testing this one, which is a very light version. It has less than 800 grams. And as I said, it's to protect the back.
Can you explain to me how this would be used by someone working in horticulture?
Yeah, so the objective of this project is to trial this technology or this solution across many different tasks on farm to understand where the greatest benefits are. But we've seen that whenever we have a task related to carry trays, for example, carry trays, bending, lifting things, so this solution could be applicable.
I understand you've done some trial work in actual horticulture operations. What sort of difference did you find?
Yeah, so early preliminary results from the trials we've been conducting with this solution in one of our industry partners have shown a reduction of around 25% in movement-related risks. And this number goes up to 64% when it comes to carrying trays.
Right. And it looks like it would be a little bit in your way, though. Like, do people notice it when they're wearing it?
They do, but it's a great support for the bag. So it's not heavy at all, and it's flexible, so it doesn't impact your movement, your natural movement. It just protects your back.
I understand there's also AI-enabled sensors, at least within the prototypes. What did that tell you?
Yeah, that's right. So we are using AI sensors to measure the level of effort without and with the exoskeletons to understand the difference and measure, to be able to measure the benefits of the solution.
This is only a prototype and a pilot program. How do you see it being rolled out within industry broader?
Yeah, we are currently running the trial phase. So once we finish this program, this project, we are going to publish the outcomes more broadly to the industry. But at the moment, we are launching an expression of interest to attract more growers that want to get involved with the solution as well, with the trials.
And what has the feedback been from people you have already engaged with?
So the feedback has been very positive, with some workers saying that the work feels easier with the suit on, which tells a lot, much more than the numbers.
And are you actually going out to try and find more farms that would be interested in using this?
That's right. So that's why we launched an expression of interest. And the idea is to bring not only more growers, but also more industries. Currently, we are trialing the solution with berry growers and also pineapple growers. And the idea is to scale this up to other industries as well.
Eduardo Barbosa, Hort Innovations R&D Manager for Emerging Technologies, speaking there. We'll head to the markets now, and Selena Green has the Dublin market for us today. Hi, Selena.
Good afternoon, Cassie. Numbers increased this week at Dublin as agents offered 7,500 lambs and 1,000 sheep. Quality was generally good across the offering, with most of the lambs in ideal trade condition. The usual trade and processor buyers were in attendance, however, one buyer did not operate. Specialty butcher competition was stronger, with restocker activity steady in a market that returned a mostly firm trend. Sheep quality was also good, with prices here also firm on the most recent sale. Light crossbred store lambs sold from $160 to $200, with the better types selling from $180 to $230 a head. Trade weights range from $250 to $265. Heavy trade weights sold from $280 to $315, with extreme heavyweights selling from $320 to $410 a head. Store merino lambs sold from $170 to $150. Trade weights range from $250 to $280, with heavyweights selling from $285 to $300, as extreme heavyweights sold from $330 to $380 a head. Light mutton sold from $140 to $190. Trade weights range from $220 to $230, with heavyweights selling from $260 to $280 a head. These numbers have been provided by John Traeger on behalf of MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks for that, Selena. And to the southeast, Peter Kerr has the markets at Mount Gambier. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon, Cassie. This is the Mount Gambier Cattle Report for the 29th of July. Numbers fell by almost half at Mount Gambier. Agents shouted 214 head of live weight and open auction cattle. These sold to most of the regular trade and processor buyers, but not all of these being active. Feeders and restocker orders were also present and active over the pens on a mixed quality offering as the market sold at cheaper rates this week. Yearlings were again small in number. The trade operated to 460 cents on steers and from 455 to 504 cents a kilogram on the heifers. Feeder order sort steers from 460 to 516 cents and heifers from 420 to 496 as restockers turned steers out from 514 to 530 cents and heifers to 498 cents a kilogram. Growing season bullocks attracted the trade from 454 to 470 cents as feeders were active from 460 to 500, with these cattle losing up to 15 cents a kilogram. Growing heifers returned from 382 to 430 cents to drop 25 cents on quality mainly, with feeder activity to 424. Heavy cows held up to only ease 3 cents. They range from 396 to 426, as lighter lots made from 355 to 386 cents, with the bulls making from 395 to 440 cents a kilogram. This has been Peter Kerr for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks for that, Peter. That's all I have time for in the Country Hour today. Thanks for joining me. You can go online to abc.net.au/rural for more rural news, or you can keep up with what's happening with the bird flu with your ABC News as well. Right now, though, it is coming up to 1 o'clock. It's approaching news time.
The Country Hour. Part of your community. And your life.
Oh, it's a bit of mix.
For 80 years.
Everything is buzzing and eating.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
That's all part of the magic.
On ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.